listening to The Nature Between Us. My name is Tessa, and I'm your host. This podcast is produced on the land of the Bidjigal and Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I acknowledge they are the traditional owners and pay my respects to elders past, present, and future. In this episode, we dive into our ocean waters to learn about our incredible coral reef systems. As beautiful as they are important, coral reefs are often called the rainforests of the sea and are some of the most diverse ecosystems in the world. But they are struggling against the effects of climate change, and some adaptation methods, like the migration of fish, might surprise you. So to get the 411 on how reef systems function, their current state, and what we can do to help them thrive, I spoke with tropical fish and coral reef expert David Booth. David is a professor of marine ecology at UTS and the past president of the Australian Coral Reef Society. He's a prominent researcher on reef fish ecology, the effects of climate change on marine life, and other anthropogenic impacts on reef systems. While his research spans areas such as Australia, the Caribbean, and Hawaii, today's conversation focuses mainly on the amazing Great Barrier Reef. Enjoy! I thought that before we talk about the impacts of climate change on reef systems, are you able to paint a picture of what a healthy reef system looks and behaves like?
Now, do you mean a tropical or a temperate or up to me to decide?
Oh, gosh. What type of reef is the Great Barrier Reef?
Yeah, well, see, the Great Barrier Reef, a lot of people don't realise, is not one big entity. It is thousands of small reefs, and some are offshore, and there's like 2,000 of those. And they go all the way from the top of Australia, like 10 degrees south, all the way down to past the Tropic of Capricorn, way down past Gladstone. And that's at about 23, like 24. So that's, you know, that's several countries. That's several Englands end to end. So, you know, it's hard to say what an actual standard one is. And there's also inshore reefs. So they're the ones along the coast. Maybe not as clean water, but there's still lots of corals and fish and stuff. But all of them probably have, you know, a lot of characteristics in common. I mean, there'll be hard corals, a whole lot of different ones, and there'll be a wide suite of different sorts of fish. So a badly disturbed reef might have more herbivores on it, or, you know, not as many carnivores, whether they've been removed through fishing or because of other reasons, lack of prey. So, you know, there's sort of a standardized set of parameters, like a wide range of types of fish. I'm a fish person, so I'm going to talk mainly about fish. There'll be a lot of what we call functional groups. They are things like carnivores, microcarnivores, there might be herbivores, detritivores, all these other fish with different sorts of eating skills. And, you know, and a more disturbed reef might have lost some of those. So if you go up into places where fishes are overexploited, you'll find, guess what's missing? The carnivores, the coral trouts and things like that will be missing. And you'll say, oh, this is a nice reef. And then you'll suddenly realise there's a whole chunk of stuff missing out of the environment. And there's usually often human-caused reason for that. So even though there's a wide variety of climates and inshore, offshore and all that, you can still kind of tell when something's amiss with a reef.
So really a healthy reef would have all of the different species that you would expect to see, and an unhealthy reef, kind of that's the first signal that you pick up on.
Yeah, and it's more like species groups. So you might miss a certain species, but there'll be another one that has the same role. And I mentioned carnivores in particular because they're often ones that go missing.
And how many of those species and fish that are on our reefs, let's just take the Great Barrier Reef, we'll use that as our kind of general example, might be easier. How many of those live there permanently, and how many are kind of passing through on currents or, you know, just visiting?
Yeah, well, there's supposedly about 1,500 species of fish on the Barrier Reef. And just to put that in context, there's about 20 to 25,000 species of fish on Earth. So nearly 10% of all fish species live on the Great Barrier Reef. And when you think of what a tiny proportion of the ocean that is, it's punching above its weight. Most of those species are residents of the reef. So, you know, that doesn't mean they only live on the Barrier Reef. You might find them in Indian Ocean even. But the individual fish, and we've found this as have others, even the big ones don't move very far. They actually, you know, a big fish might move a couple hundred metres or a bit more. Some of the fish we work on that we've actually tagged on the reef and follow them for over a decade have moved a meter in their whole lives. So that's pretty local. So a lot of these fish don't have, now having said that, they have babies and the babies do the moving. So the babies will hatch and they'll be out in the open ocean. And that's why in our projects in Sydney and further south, we're finding these tropical fish babies coming all that way, because it's the babies that do the moving and the adults stay put. So most coral reef fishes, at least the adults, don't move far. There are a few bigger things that come in, like tunas and marlin and things like that, that do have a wider range.
Can you give me an example of that species that only moves 1 meter? I'm imagining a very kind of lazy fish.
Oh, come on. They're very busy. Now, well, everyone knows Nemo. So that's probably one of the good examples. So Nemo's an anemone fish. And we now know that a lot of those fish, when they produce babies, the babies will go out into the ocean and come back almost to the same spot. So they're a bit unusual in that they home, but the adults will live on an anemone their whole life. And so they'll have their babies, they'll interact, everything within that small space. And the fish we worked on is called a lemon damsel fish. That fish we tagged a whole bunch on the northern reef and at Lizard Island, and on the southern reef at a place called One Tree Island back in about 2000. And then every year we'd go back, and among other things, we'd go searching for our tagged fish. They were tagged with tiny little things we could see. And so we knew exactly that particular fish was found on exactly that spot. And then we could say, oh, it's moved half a meter. I think we found one fish that moved 7 meters. That was the world record holder. So that's the width of a normal room, right? But yeah. Most of them were within a meter, even after 11 years. So they found a spot as babies and they liked it. They stayed. And they could forage around there. They could get their food. They could have their babies, everything like that within that very, very small space.
Awesome. And how do the fish species interact with the coral? And how does that change when the coral health is diminishing?
Many fish on the reef don't have a direct use for the coral, but they do indirectly need it. So first of all, there's some fish that really rely on the coral. A couple of the butterfly fish have a particular propensity for a certain crop or a coral, a particular species. And once that species is gone, they disappear from the area. So when we see a bleaching event, which, as you know, is can lead to loss of coral, some of those species, if they're gone, that particular species is gone. Most fish, including most butterfly fish, are a little more eclectic. They can shift around. They can eat from corals or from the bottom, or they can take plankton in the water column. So they're a bit more flexible, but they often need the coral for shelter. So that's another use. They also are camouflaged sometimes against the coral. So I don't know if you know what bleached coral looks like, but as you can imagine, it turns bright white. And so some of these fish, including anemone fish, because the anemones bleach as well, they're related to corals, they stick out like a sore thumb. And so they're more susceptible to predators. So they do use the coral for shelter and also food. And even the ones that don't use it directly for food can be in trouble. And we did some studies, and we are doing some studies on the southern reef. In fact, we're up to about 30 years of looking now. And the fish can suffer with coral bleaching, even if they're not directly coral lovers, just because the whole area kind of degrades. So, yeah, so no coral, pretty much no fish in the long term.
I guess that leads a nice way into talking about how the reef is degrading, which is something you've been studying for quite a while. When was the first time that you noticed changes to the Great Barrier Reef, and what were they?
Well, I mean, I suppose the best way to notice a change is going back to the same spot again and again, because if I went to one spot in the reef and went to somewhere else, because there's such variation, a difference might just be due to the difference between the two sites.
Yeah.
So I suppose we've been going to sites in the Caribbean and also sites on the southern reef, this One Tree Island I've been speaking about, which is University of Sydney's research station. We've been going there since about 91, 92. So that's getting back there now. That's about 30 years.
Yeah.
The southern reef has been relatively lucky with the whole degradation of the reef with coral bleaching. And so the northern sites, my colleagues tell me, are in much poorer shape than they were. So you can really see a difference. Some of the sites at One Tree Island have degraded badly. Other sites have maintained themselves. There was a big bleaching event in 1998. That was the one that brought this whole degradation of the reef to world prominence. And it had devastating effects across the Barrier Reef. But most of those sites were able to recover. And I can tell you how that happened if you like. But at One Tree Island, because of the way it's set up and the fact that it held the hot water for longer, it actually, some of those sites didn't recover and have not recovered to this day. Whereas some of the other sites have flourished and the fish are doing well. So it's quite patchy, but yeah, in general, it's been a downgrade.
So you started first noticing changes back in like the early 90s. Is that?
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, there's always changes. I mean, it's not a static thing. With, yeah. You know, the good thing about looking for so long, you can see changes that others wouldn't have seen. So we've seen certain fish species that were very common back in the early 90s have pretty much disappeared. No apparent reason, whereas others have flourished. So, you know, there's comings and goings, and that's the background, which makes it difficult to detect change. But as I said, there are certain places, say on the place we're working, where there's been a big degradation and a big loss of fish. So there's clearly a downgrade in those areas, but not others.
Let's talk about climate change and how it affects the reef. You said that you're a fish guy, but I was also hoping to hear about coral and how it affects coral. And so, can you kind of give a bit of a snapshot on how climate change is affecting our reefs?
Yeah, well, climate change is one of a number of stresses on reefs. So we class them as there's some natural stresses. I mean, massive cyclones come through and that sort of thing. These can have devastating effects on reefs naturally. There's a whole suite of what we think are human-caused things. One of the earliest big ones was the attacks by crown of thorns sea stars. Now, these are incredible, and you still see them on the reef. These large, you know, giant, maybe up to half a metre across, spiny sea stars that can erupt in large numbers on reefs and just about eat the whole reef out. They eat live corals and they leave a devastation behind. So these sorts of attacks have been happening quite a lot for a number of years and have been partly attributed to humans fishing out their predators and that sort of thing. But as I mentioned, in 1998, back in 1980 was the first time we saw a bleached reef. And it's pretty hard to miss it. It's all white. The corals have gone white. And this has increased in frequency and intensity, culminating, I think, 2016 and 2017, and to a lesser extent, 2020, mass bleaching events. Luckily, mainly on the northern reef, but not entirely, and globally as well. So this is number one. So what's this caused by? Mainly temperature increases. Now, corals, even though they live in tropical waters, it turns out they can't handle temperatures way above their normal. So if a reef gets to 30 and then all of a sudden it gets to 32, what happens is the coral doesn't die straight away. The reason the coral is that pretty colour is it has an algal cell inside it, a set of algal cells, and they're being hosted by the coral. And they produce, through photosynthesis, a lot of the coral's food. So if it gets too hot, they go, we're out of here. They jump out and they swim freely away. The coral has no more pigments. It's not coloured anymore. It turns white. It's not dead yet because corals actually are related to jellyfish and they can eat by themselves. But they're still a going concern. And in fact, if other of these little algal cells decide to re-inhabit them, they can get the colour back and recover. However, if it stays hot and things are grim, the coral will then die and then get covered in slimy algae and things like that. So this sort of process happens. And so it's hard to miss, which is good in a way because you can see it from the air. You can see white corals and you know there's coral bleaching. So the good thing is, I suppose, we can do global surveys, helicopter surveys and things to check this out. So we know that it probably has never happened in human history before the 1980 because no one's ever seen it. Peoples of the Pacific, like the Samoans, are very attuned to the reef and make really good records and they'd never seen it before. So we know this mass bleaching is something new. We also know it's caused by temperature. There are other things as well. The other great spectre of climate change is CO2. Now, we're now learning this is very insidious and the ocean is a really good sink for CO2. So all the CO2 we've produced through industry has gone somewhere. Part of it might be the rainforest, but a lot of it's gone into the ocean. The plankton have taken it up. The seagrass has taken it up and without any change in the ocean. So it's buffered. And if too much CO2 makes the ocean acid. But all of a sudden in the last few years, it's had enough. It's taken in so much carbon dioxide, all of a sudden things are going wrong. What's going wrong? Well, for one thing, anything with a calcium carbonate skeleton, like a coral or a shell, is in trouble because the acid can dissolve that. So on top of that, fish themselves are affected. Their behavior gets affected when it's too acid. They make wrong decisions. They can get eaten. So there's all these things happening that aren't just the temperature effect on the corals. It's all these other things with ocean acidification. and a few other things as well, all linked to climate change, all linked to humans. And, you know, and in Australia, of course, we have some of the most otherwise pristine reefs being damaged.
I have two questions to follow up with. The first is, when the little algae that are on the coral skeleton kind of abort because of the temperature, are they kind of floating around just trying to find somewhere warmer? And then how long do they live floating around, or do they eventually kind of, you assume that they die?
Well, that's a really good question. You probably want to get a coral physiologist for the full answer, but they certainly can inoculate corals from the water column so they can come back in. Individuals, I'm not quite sure how long they'll last, et cetera, but they can be free living. And there's obviously some sort of advantage to them in living in a coral protection, et cetera. So it's advantageous for those sort of little algal cells to live in the corals. But I guess if the hot water persists for too long, they either move on or die out, and there's nothing there to re-inoculate the corals, and they will eventually die.
And can they swim independently, or are they reliant on currents like floating them down?
Yeah, very good question. A lot of algae are fairly much relying on currents. They might have a bit of lipid, a bit of fat in them, stops them sinking. They can have little flagella, little hairs along the sides of them, and can move a little bit, but they'd be no match for any sort of current, as opposed to baby fish, which can actually, we're finding out, swim very fast and very long.
Awesome. Yeah, and that was the second question. You mentioned that the increase of the ocean acidification is changing fish behaviour. Do you mean like it's making them a little bit loopy?
That's a very good way of putting it, a little bit loopy. Studies by my colleagues up north suggest that if the ocean CO2 content gets too high, fish can make wrong choices. So some of these studies showed that, you know, fish generally avoid predators. You know, that's how come they're surviving. They'll see a predator, they'll go the other way. But in some cases, when at high treatments of high CO2, the fish would swim straight towards a predator. Mechanism a little bit unknown, but, you know, it's quite a change. So that is devastating. That is a very, very poor trait to have. And that seems to be because of this slight increase in ocean acidity or CO2.
Right. Has there been any species a fish that you've noticed has been able to kind of adapt to the warming waters and the ocean acidification, or has everyone kind of been affected kind of equally?
Yeah, we're not really clear. Obviously, every fish has a different propensity, a different susceptibility. The ocean warming, I can probably answer a little bit more than the CO2 at this point. But certainly, fish have different performances at different temperatures, and they're not warm-blooded like us. So they'll perform generally better at warmer temperatures. So, for instance, the little fish we monitor that have come down with the EAC down to Sydney, for instance, from up north, we've done lots of work with them looking at their metabolism, their growth at different temperatures. And sure enough, as you might expect, they grow more at the warmer temperatures. The Sydney winter temperature, which is about 18 degrees, they really slow down their growth. Whereas the local similar species do a lot better.
I've heard someone mention a while ago, and I think you are also deep into doing research on this, about what's the impact of fish that haven't historically been in a section of a reef kind of migrating?
Thank you. This is one I can answer. This is our main one of our main research projects. We've been studying this for 20 years. We're nearly into our third decade of looking at this. That is looking at the sorts of tropical fishes that come down the coast. So we actually predate Nemo, the movie Nemo, on this one. And looking
Very cool.
At, yes, I know, isn't that cool? So we've been looking at these tropical fishes coming into Sydney waters and further south to the New South Wales border with Victoria, to a place called Merimbula and Eden. And it turns out the tropical waters that come down in the summer months, the East Australian Current, you've probably heard about, this can make it pretty much down to that point where New South Wales finishes on the south coast, then it heads out to sea. So on board are a lot of different things, it turns out, not just fish, but as I'll talk about in a minute, corals as well, and invertebrates of other sorts, algae and things like that. So what we've recorded by just going out looking on a regular basis is around about January, February each year, in they come, a bunch of different species. So we've recorded about 80 to 90 tropical fish species coming into Sydney, about 40 or 50 making it all the way down to Merimbula, which is further south. These are butterfly fishes, damsel fishes, not Nemo, but similar groups, surgeon fishes, Moorish idols, all sorts of really cool, colourful creatures. They'll come down and they'll be quite numerous till around May, about now. Then they'll start dying off as the temperature drops. If a storm comes by, that makes it happen even faster. And then around about July, August, there'll be a few hardy individuals that might even overwinter. And we're now finding a few that's make it through the winter. That's called overwintering. And that seems to be going up a bit in recent years, and certainly is more on warmer years. So it's above 18 degrees. That's the magic number. We'll find a lot more make it through the winter. To top this off, we're also finding a new species of coral that's expanding down here, a postelopid coral that's found all the way from the very, very southern reef all the way down here. But the amount of it here is spreading. And what we've been finding is that it's not only arriving itself and spreading, it's also bringing with it about four or five tropical fish species that we had not seen before, and some other things like crabs that are tropical. So the current and the warmer temperatures are helping the tropicals, but also this new habitat is helping them as well.
Is it helping them though if they end up kind of jumping aboard the current thinking that they're going somewhere nice and warm, but then they end up somewhere that's cold and then they die?
It's a bit of a shock individually, I'm sure. Having said that, you know, the temperature's going up here, and this all, and when tropical fishes and many ocean fishes produce a lot of babies, thousands of babies, and maybe one or two survive. So they're spreading their load. As I mentioned earlier with the little clownfish up north, some of them actually come back to the same spot, but a lot of them go with the current. And then later on, when they get a bit bigger, maybe after a few weeks, they can swim. They actually, you know, are on board these currents and then get deposited maybe where they don't want to be. But the idea is in future, it might be a more suitable habitat for them.
I can't help but think it's like investing in a new neighbourhood that isn't fancy yet, but might get fancy.
That's right. Yeah, you're sort of hoping, get in on the ground floor and then the prices will rise. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and of course, what are there's temperate fish here too, and they're maybe not so happy with all of this. Although, you know, we've shown in the summer months, you know, the numbers of tropicals are up to about 15 or 20% of all the fish on the reef there. So they're tasty treats. They're very small, you know, so they're providing a bit of a food resource for the local predators.
Right. Oh, okay. Are there any other impacts that they have that maybe aren't positive? I heard maybe that they eat seagrass or kelp forests.
Yeah, well, there's lots of different tropicals, and there's a group called the surgeon fishes. And again, aficionados of Nemo will know what dory was. Dory is a surgeon fish.
We've
seen one in Sydney Harbour, a pallet surgeon fish. And that group of fish are a little bit more insidious in the sense that they can actually harm kelp and some of those environments as well. And so this phenomenon is really taking off because the last few years, one of the trends we've seen is, yes, generally there's more tropicals, but in particular, the surgeon fishes are on the rise. Some of them are benign, but others may cause a few problems. The other thing that's happening along with the fish are sea urchins. Now, sea urchins, there's local sea urchins, but there's these tropical ones. And some people say they're marching down the coast. Well, they're not actually marching, but they are getting further and further south, even into Tasmania. And what's happened with them is they are chewing up the kelp. They're very good at chopping off the kelp, stopping it grow. And in its place, if anyone snorkels, you'll see it's large areas of what we call barrens. They're large, like sandstone rocks, and they're pink colour because they're covered with a very strong algae that can't get eaten. So the habitat becomes this. Now, the tropicals love it, but things like lobsters and abalone do not like it. They like the kelp. So as you go into Tasmania, this is quite devastating to the abalone and the lobster fisheries, is the removal of this kelp by these sea urchins. And the interesting story to me here is we want to segue into marine parks, is that there's some large marine parks like Moriah Island down there. They are some of the only places you find large stands of kelp. So, and also within them are large lobsters. As you go outside the marine park, the lobsters are fished. So you only have small lobsters, which if they were bigger, they could actually eat and destroy the urchins. Because they're small, they don't. So the urchin barrens. So inside marine parks, there's kelp and large lobsters. Outside, there's no kelp and tiny lobsters. So the fishers are realising the benefits of having some marine parks around.
That's interesting. It's always like when you hear people talking about sharks and, you know, the question like, well, why don't we kill them? It's like, well, no, we need the bigger predators and the bigger species to kind of keep everything in sync, so to speak.
And of course, we, you know, it'd be unfair to say we know everything that's going on. So, you know, it's like the tropical rainforest when they're clearing them. We're probably losing species we haven't even yet discovered that may have huge human benefits for medicine. You know, and it's just frightening that we're actually going to be taking away things from the ocean or from rainforests or whatever by human use before we even know what's available for us there.
Yeah. Why are the sea urchins marching, so to speak?
It's clearly climate change. And, you know, they, you know, each animal has its own temperature preference. This particular group of sea urchins has a certain temperature preference. Previously, it was too cold for them down here. But, you know, in recent years, it's getting warmer. As I said, the winters are getting warmer. They spread through the plankton and then take up residence on reefs and then live there and chew up whatever they can. And then they're able to move further south. And now, because of the warmer waters off Tasmania, they're able to enter that area. And there's local sea urchins, but they're sort of, I guess you'd say, they're in balance with the local environment. And then these new guys come in. You know, the indirect effects, in this case, on the lobster industry, ironically, partly because the fishers had fished out all the big lobster. You know, the urchins come in and, yes, et cetera. So there's all sorts of interactions going on. And we're just understanding this the hard way by finding out when a perturbation like this happens, like invading sea urchins, we go, oh, isn't the ocean neat? But it's sometimes a bit late.
Yeah, it's so incredible. And I can imagine that sometimes it might take 5 to 10 years to see these changes fully take effect.
Right. And this is a problem. Some of the management of the coast, obviously one of the management tools are marine parks and protected areas where you're not supposed to fish. Sometimes recently the various governments have said, look, maybe for political reasons, there's a protected area here. Let's remove it and let people fish there. Usually not consulting with the scientists. The trouble with that is it's a one-way thing. You can very quickly remove the predatory fish from an area, say through fishing, but it takes a lot longer to have them recover. So if you make a mistake and open up an area, say for fishing, you can't go next week, oh, let's put it back on again. You've got to wait years and years for it to build up. So you've got to be very careful with management because the recovery rate of these areas can be decades.
Mm. It seems like the protected areas are almost like a snapshot of how it should look, you know, like for reference. You go, yes. Oh, let's look in the marine park. Oh, that's how it all should be working. And then we look everywhere else and we're like,
indeed. That's... And in fact, that's one of the benefits for these areas is that you can, a bit of history, you know, for instance, Australia has generally pretty well managed fisheries, but they're managed for sustainability or, you know, keeping the population stable. But quite often these fish have been fished down historically to 10% of their biomass. And they might be stable at 10%, but that ain't natural. That's not how it was back then. So marine parks, I suppose, one of the benefits are areas where you can see how they were. And scientists like to work in them as reference areas. So, yeah, when you look outside a marine park and compare it with inside, you can really see the difference usually.
Yeah. I want to go back. I know you've said you're a fish guy, but I do want to go back to talking about reefs and bleaching, mm-hmm. And coral bleaching. Are there any ways of knowing when a bleaching event is about to happen?
Yes, there's some pretty good predictability, and there's some global products, often through the American NOAA, the National Oceans and Atmospheric Administration. You can look at them online yourself, they're public viewing, and they'll have like coral watch charts, basically based on temperature. Like here's a big coral heating event that's happening in the tropics. It's heading for Japan or heading for Northern Australia or heading for the Caribbean. You can expect a bleaching event next week. So it's like a forecast.
Oh, okay. Like the weather.
So these are fairly available. But just like the weather, you can't go, okay, well, I'll prevent that happening. You can't do it. It's really just here it comes, better watch it. So it's a value in predictability, but not in fixing things, I suppose you could say.
You mentioned previously that in 2016 and 2017, we had two mass bleaching events on the Great Barrier Reef back to back. What were the impacts of those events? And do you think that those areas that were badly affected will ever bounce back from it?
Yeah, it was interesting because we actually had a short trips up to our southern reef site at One Tree Island both those years. And when I'd heard about the devastation on the northern reef, which incidentally is where most of the coral is, we were ready for something there to happen. And we got there and we were pleasantly surprised that it wasn't that bad. But the reason it wasn't was because they'd had a lot of cloudy weather. So that whole area had not been as affected just by a fluke. You know, if there wasn't cloudy weather, it would have been devastated. And in fact, the next year, the tourists arrived in droves. The message had got out, if you want to see corals, come to the southern reef. So there was a massive tourism backlash from the lack of corals up north. And so, for 2 years in a row, they had massive bleaching. And the corals, maybe 50% of them did not recover. So especially the 1-2 punch in both years. So there are large areas there where the corals haven't recovered. Now, eventually, other corals, baby corals, will come in. And so that's why, or one of the impetuses for a lot of the research at the moment looking at coral restoration, where they're trying to farm corals or pick particularly climate-proof corals and reseed them on the reef.
Will those corals impact the biodiversity and that kind of like relationship that you were describing before with the fish and all the other creatures?
Yeah, no. I mean, there's some really interesting science done on coral restoration. But the simple math says it's like, you know, we've lost all the cheetahs in Africa, thinking that we can breed a few up in the zoo and pop them back over there. It's not going to happen. It's part of the story. There's no way, and through no amount of expense, I think it was estimated $1 trillion would be needed to reseed the reef. Now, there are 300 or 400 or whatever species of coral, and the coral restoration work probably deals with a dozen or whatever. So you can imagine it's not the fix we're looking for. It's not a reason to keep going with climate change because we can fix it. There's some, as I said, interesting research, but I don't think it's the panacea. Of course, a lot of people would like to think we've got a solution. We all want a solution. Unfortunately, it's a hard problem, and the solution is reducing climate change. And, of course, Australia is a small country, but you could argue we export climate change to the world through our coal exports. And, you know, we're really punching above our weight in this sad matter.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's a bit embarrassing, isn't it, when you think about it?
True, yes, yes.
So after 2016, 2017, it seemed like the Great Barrier Reef kind of had a couple of years where it didn't have any mass bleaching events. How is it looking now? Are you up to date? Like how often are we having new events?
Personally, I'll tell you next week, although we were at Heron Island last week with the students and there is evidence of bleaching, you know, the corals, you can sort of tell they've lost a bit of their colour, etc. We'll be going up to One Tree Island next week for our ongoing, pretty much a 30th year of monitoring up there. So I'm curious to see, but my understanding from other scientists is the bleaching event this year, while not as devastating, was more widespread. And so the southern reef, which seems to have dodged the bullet, copped it a bit this year. So yeah, it varies year to year, but remember, just a couple of decades ago there was none. So now we're getting it, say, 2 out of 6 years or 5 years we're getting devastating bleaching. So this is the problem. The frequency and intensity are both changing.
What will happen if the reef just dies? Like how will that affect humans on land?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? I mean, you can always talk about what they call the ecosystem services of loss of an ecosystem. So, you know, whether it's the bush after the bushfire, you know, we're still living okay in Sydney, even though we had a devastating bushfire, which had horrible consequences. So it's not necessarily, you know, instant destruction of Australia, but certainly there are ecosystem services of the reef, whether it's fisheries or whatever. But the esoteric value of having such an amazing habitat that the world looks to and not looking after it properly is awful. You know, people can say, oh, the reef helps protect the coast from storms. You know, if that's the main reason for keeping the reef, that'd be a bit sad. A lot of people haven't been there, but just, I don't know, I think just knowing this amazing natural habitat's there and Australia's looking after it is pretty special.
And it sounds like the balance of keeping all of those species happy, like just keeping the whole system in balance is how you want to have it.
Yeah, and of course the reef itself, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, it had shrunk down to an area towards where the middle of the reef is. So there's comings and goings over thousands of years. The big difference is this is happening over decades, you know, 100 times as fast. So it's just not natural. You know, it's not, the reef's not static, it's changing, bits are dying, bits are increasing. But that scale is of thousands of years, whereas we're losing it over the tens of years. So that's the problem.
You mentioned the coral restoration processes. Are there any other programs or strategies that are being implemented to try and help stabilize or adapt the reef?
Yeah, well, there's local things. I mean, there's the whole restoration project where they can either outplant corals or they can capture coral larvae and put them somewhere else, which, as I said, is quite interesting, but I don't see it as a fix at the scale that, that a reef needs. There's also protection of fisheries by protected areas and things like that. Because as I mentioned with the Tasmanian context, marine parks have a bit of a buffering effect on climate change. They don't stop it, they might slow it down. But all the other fixes to me are large scale. Stop digging coal out of the ground, you know, use things wisely. Even plastic bags come from oil and natural gas and that sort of thing. So, you know, the whole coal and oil culture is just pretty alarming. And I think, you know, even governments may not be on board, but certainly industry is, insurance companies, banks are realizing we have to divest ourselves from coal and use alternative energy. And of course, ultimately, there's a lot of us. There's 7 billion or whatever people on Earth. That's probably beyond the carrying capacity of the Earth in the current situation. So, you know, all these problems, whether they're climate change, too many plastics in the ocean, deforestation, you know, they can all be brought back to individual and group human use of resources.
Have you noticed an increase of plastics in the Great Barrier Reef? And does that affect the fish and the coral as well?
Well, when you go out to the reef and even to a remote location, you'll find plastic things. A lot of them are like drink bottles or fishing floats or fishing nets and that sort of thing. And that is a major problem. You've heard of the big ocean garbage patch and all those sorts of things. More insidiously, more recently, people are discovering these microplastics, less than half a millimeter, whether in fish guts or in whatever, or in their tissue or just in the sediments on the reef. I mean, swimming over, you won't notice these, but they are there. So it has increased, although, you know, not alarmingly, I suppose, but we don't know the insidious effects of these microplastics. And so it is a really big issue, but I think it's dwarfed by climate change and the role that that's playing on the reef.
Yeah, definitely. But do you know if there was any funding in the federal budget that was just announced last week that's going towards the reef or...
I must admit, I didn't hear of anything. I'm sure there was some sort of allocation. A while ago, the government gave an amount, I think it was $500 million to the Great Barrier Foundation to disseminate to various projects on the reef. A lot of them were things like coral restoration.
Yeah, right. And what can people do to help? Is going, like, is visiting the reef, is that putting added pressure or is that kind of... Okay.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, obviously people like myself and maybe you and a lot of the listeners will go, we want to conserve the reef because it's the reef. We're proud of it and all that. But a lot of people will go, well, what's it done for us? So one of the major things one can do by visiting the reef is increase the tourist numbers. So we've used time and again in our coral societies and things like that, lobbying the government saying, look, do you really want to threaten the reef? It's worth X billion dollars as a tourist attraction and it puts Australia on the local and global tourist map. So, yeah, I reckon visiting the reef, A, to see it, because you've got to see it. It's just awesome. But also just to add to those numbers, to give a bit of credence to the fact that the reef has a commercial value.
Yeah.
I think that's one way to do it. You know, I mean, it's you feel very helpless in this world of climate change, but I think the old acting locally is a good one, but also, you know, keeping the politicians honest about this, making sure your local person knows that that's a priority that you think is important, I think is a good idea.
You've inspired me to go back to the reef. I went once when I was 15 with my family, but I've been meaning to go back. So maybe this year's the year to go.
I think it would be provided COVID lets us. But yes, we've been up recently and you know, a lot of the spots we go in look beautiful. I mean, yes, there's bleaching in some areas, but, you know, just a spectacular display of wildlife up there.
Do you have a favourite fish?
Well, I have to sort of, I should really pick damselfish of different sorts, including Nemo. Mm-hmm. But there are some amazing little animals out there. We've recently been having a bit of a look at some of the goby little fish that live in holes between the reefs. And there's, you know, the behaviours and the antics that these guys get up to are pretty amazing. So they might be my current favourite group of fish, these little gobies. It changes all the time, but there's just so many. And if you're in the water, a lot of people just swim as fast as they can, but the trick in the reef is to find a nice spot snorkeling and just stop and look. And because it's so warm, you can do this. and just watch a fish or watch something and just stay in one spot, and all of a sudden the reef becomes alive and you can see some very comical antics by fish.
Yeah. What do the goby fish do that's so funny?
Well, these are the ones, these particular, there's three or four or more species that live in the same little hole. So if you watch them for a while, they'll pop in and out, they'll interact with each other, some will remove sand, a shrimp will pop out, they'll have a bit of a chase, you know, so it's just like a big happy family in there. Yeah. And then the territorial damselfish will chase parrotfish from their small territory, and you know, really it is, it's better than a TV drama, I think.
Yeah. Well, recently they turned the, have you seen My Octopus Teacher?
I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard so much about it, I've got to have a look. Yeah, so it's that sort of thing. Yeah, you really realise these things aren't just entities, they're personalities.
Yeah, totally. There's a seal that swims off the coast at Maroubra, and this, I see it like most mornings, but this morning it was just on its side with its flipper up just like that. And I was like, what is it doing? Is it fishing?
Is it waving? Yeah. Well, we do work at the Opera House. We have a little setup next to the Opera House, some little reefs we put in. And we were there the other day, and they're doing some filming, but who should pop up but a seal? Whizzing around, doing its little hand-waving thing, right, just where we were about to jump in. We didn't see it in the water, but the people on shore saw it. So it's just amazing to think, here's an urban harbour. We should be pretty proud of Sydney Harbour, even though there's some issues. You know, we found over 600 species of fish there. Seals come in, whales sometimes come in. There's sea dragons that we work on are right there. And so, you know, for an urban harbour with millions of people around it, it's a very special place. We don't have to go to the reef to see all that.
Yeah. Well, snorkeling tours around Sydney Harbour, dodging the ferry, can that work?
That could work. Well, we do a lot of our work at Cabbage Tree Bay in Sydney. We've, again, had 20 years of sampling, and the corals are just around the corner there. So, you know, on a nice day, it's a pretty special place there.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because I did want to ask you about the project that you're working on around the Sydney Opera House. What is it?
Yeah, well, like any urban harbour, a lot of the foreshore is being developed. So that's happened for 200 years in Sydney. So there's some beautiful rock walls like around the Botanic Gardens that have replaced probably mangroves and oyster reefs and things like that. So we've removed a lot of this habitat, seagrass and that sort of thing. There's a little bit left in Sydney. And so those walls and the walls around the Opera House are, you know, there's some habitat for fish and there's kelp and that sort of thing. But, you know, through many, many decades, this has been lost. Wharves have been built, sort of shaded out the seagrass, et cetera. So this particular project is a collaboration with the Opera House, who've been just fantastic, to put these small purpose-built reefs, very, very small, along the edge of the walls of the Opera House, just to see if we can, I guess, entice some of the small fishes and therefore some of the bigger fishes back. And it seems to have happened. So we've been doing this for 2 or 3 years now, and we're seeing fish species we hadn't really noticed before there. And these are using the reefs themselves. They're inside them and they're using them as a bit of home base. And so we're also comparing that with our surveys all around the harbour. And, yeah, so this project's just really just to see if we can enhance biodiversity, particularly fish, by some small adjustments, let's just say, to the built environment on the shore of the Opera House.
So those reefs are in place and you're going to continue to monitor, or are you putting in new reefs?
Yeah, no, they'll be there until we're finished. But pretty much, of course, what happens is they're made of biodegradable metal and concrete, and they encrust with beautiful sponges and algae and things like that, which are interesting in themselves, but they also provide home for small fishes and invertebrates and things like that. So, you know, it's a whole little ecosystem, I guess you could say, sort of developing there. And yeah, it's just an addition of habitat that wasn't there already, and it seems to be helping.
To find out more about David's research and the Opera House Reef Project, head to uts.edu.au. And don't forget to go in the running to win a mega prize pack from sustainable brands Spooked Kooks, FPR, and Camp Cove Swim. All you have to do is leave a rating and review on iTunes/Apple Podcasts, subscribe to the pod, and follow all three Insta accounts plus the pod at The Nature Between Us Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'll catch you next ep.